Time is 1:10, and we have present for the record Representative Guerra, Representative Holm, Samuels, Vice Chairman Anderson, and myself, Representative McGuire. The date is April 23rd, and we have three items on the agenda today. House Bill 102, Concealed Deadly Weapons by Representative Croft, and then we have House Bill 31 and H.J.R. 5, Initiative and Referendum Petitions by Representative Williams. And then third up, we'll have House Bill number 86, Injunctions Against Permitted Projects by Representative Fate. And judiciary will go longer today. I know Vanessa's let all of you know that. And Representative Anderson will have to leave us early to go to Labor and Commerce and work on RCA. So with that, Representative Croft. And it looks like we do have three people online, and for the people online, if you can, we'll go to you, and Representative Croft is at the table now, but we'll go ahead and hear from you. If you could try to limit your comments to 3 to 5 minutes, that would be great. We've got a big agenda today, and then so we can get stuff moving through, we'd appreciate it. So with that, I will go to Mrs. May Alice Hopkins out of the Kenai LIO. Mrs. Hopkins, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Thank you. If you could just state your name and whatever you want to be affiliated with for the record, and then please proceed.
Yes, my name is May Alice Hopkins, and I'm here for myself. I'm not affiliated with them.
That's the best way to be. All right, proceed.
My concern with HB 102 is with the part that Representative Cross described as relating to Vermont laws, concealed carry of a deadly weapon. This allows a person to meet current requirements for a concealed weapon permit to carry a concealed weapon, but without a permit. And I am wondering what the process of determining that that person does meet the current requirements is this to be done by a registration of intent to carry, or is it to come up when the born carrying is approached by law enforcement? Does this portion of the bill place increased responsibility on law enforcement? And will law enforcement have access to the names of those who are carrying without a permit, or do they just assume that anyone may be carrying? As a permit holder, I know the importance of the citizen having knowledge of the laws for concealed carry of a deadly weapon. What might be restrictions on what they are to do? Also, I feel most important is that they have the knowledge and skill in handling that firearm that they are carrying. It is vital for the safety of everyone in the community. I'm wondering who will check to be sure that the carrier does have a good understanding of the laws and that they know their firearm. I do not see that these concerns are addressed in the bill, but I believe it is definitely a community concern. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hopkins, and I will direct your questions to Representative Croft, who's here at the table.
You want to go through all the testimony, or you want to address them?
No, because we only have three, so why don't you respond to that, and then we'll move forward.
Thank you, May Alice. There would be no list kept by government, and I do think it, I'm a permit holder as well. I thought much of the information was useful, but right now somebody does not have to take any test, and the government keeps no list of people who own guns, and I don't, the distinction that we're addressing here is between a concealed or not. And no, I wouldn't be in favor of the government having that list necessarily. We do think that in a number of areas we've helped law enforcement by extending more broadly the requirement that you tell them, but the bill, the express reason for the bill really is to not have some of these requirements.
Ms. Hopkins, any response?
My one response is that I feel that quite often people are overconfident They may think that they understand what is needed for them to carry, and that they may understand everything there is to know about the firearm that they are carrying, but they may not really be as skilled as they need to be, and might find themselves in a lot of trouble.
Fair enough. Thank you very much, Mrs. Hopkins, for coming down today and making your views known to the Judiciary Committee. And with that, I have one other person in the Kenai LIO, Mr. John Smallwood. Okay, if you want to go ahead and state your name for the record, and then please proceed with your testimony, Mr. Smallwood.
John Smallwood. I live in Sedona. I'm also a permit holder. And as far as having permits for the state, it could be or not a good idea. Laws in effect that protects most citizens. You're not allowed to have a firearm on your possession for home or any place else unless you're qualified and not prohibited by federal or state law. We have an instant check system here for the police officers already for people to have permits. I think that might be a good idea if the officers are concerned about safety. And if you've done away with the permit system, then you'd be in within the law of the Constitution like Vermont. But then some people might think it's not good enough. Senator Taylor last year passed a bill, I think 142, on Pacific Sea with all the other states. And the bill cut down from the first part of it as being the requirements as strict as the state of Alaska. Not like it says simply some kind of a instruction, and then it's kind of vague and it doesn't mean much of anything. I kind of like the idea of a person who's going to carry a concealed weapon and be amongst fellow citizens that they at least have some kind of training and maybe a good knowledge of the concealed weapons laws and these laws on self-defense. If you have just some kind, that means a guy can go out in the field, teach you how to load the gun, shoot it down the range, and that's all the instructions you have. That would be the only concern that I would have. As far as a concealed weapons permit, I don't really care one way or the other. It's a good idea, and it's if you don't have it, then Vermont's correct because they're going along with the Constitution of the state and the United States, and we are too. We specifically have it in our Constitution that the right to carry a concealed weapon for legitimate purposes is indeed a right of the individual. So there's no argument there. It's just up to whoever feels it's safer. We have other issues, but I don't think it should be taken up here at this time. On improvements, so whatever they think is appropriate, I'm willing to go along with, but you're allowing other people to come in the state, and they don't have the training.
Okay. Thank you, Representatives. Pardon me, Mr. Smallwood. Okay. That concludes Kenai, and then we have Bryant Judy. Mr. Judy is back with us in... doesn't say where you are. You're off net. Brian, are you there?
I am, Madam Chairman.
Welcome. Would you like to offer any further testimony on House Bill 102 today?
Well, Madam Chair, at this point, I think that I spoke fairly extensively last week and answered a number of questions, so I will just make myself available if there are any further questions at this point.
Okay. Thank you very much, Brian. Oh, Representative Guerra does have a question.
Thank you. Mr. Judy, this is Les Guerra speaking. Can you just state for the record briefly the most significant parts of the handgun training courses that wouldn't be required if we don't, if we pass this bill? The sort of safety aspects of those courses that I think maybe stand out to you the most.
Madam Chair, Representative Guerra, I'm not exactly sure what you're asking because the since you would not have to obtain a permit under the provisions of this new law, there would not be any training requirements.
I'm sorry, I didn't ask the question clearly. I'm talking about the training requirements that exist today. I guess the big concern is that if we pass this bill, then some segment of the population who is now required to go take the safety courses won't take the courses. And we had a debate about whether that'll be a lot of people or just a few people who won't take the courses anymore. But I think it would be nice to have on the record maybe what the most significant aspect of those courses involve.
Madam Chair, Representative Garrett, as I mentioned last week, it's my assertion of the NRA, that the training courses really don't add that much to the safety situation in the state of Alaska. As I mentioned last week, there are many states along a broad spectrum, going from no training requirements to significant training requirements. And all those, the empirical evidence from all those states is the same, and that is that there just aren't any training-related problems. And as I also pointed out last week, in the state of Alaska currently, you do not need anything in terms of training, permit requirements to carry openly. So basically, under the existing law, an individual to put on a coat to basically cover the firearm has to take the training and has to go through all the other bureaucratic hoops. And there's no problem in Alaska with people carrying openly, and there's no problem under existing law with Alaskans who are carrying concealed, who are engaged in an outdoor activity, another exemption from the permit requirement. So there's just nothing to indicate that there's a problem now with people who don't go through a mandatory training course, and I don't think that would change.
Representative Guerra?
Thanks, Mr. Judy. I appreciate that, and that was the point that I think a number of people made last hearing, which was maybe there isn't a problem, and I appreciate that. But I guess what I'm trying to get a sense of is I'm wondering what the minimum requirements are under state law right now for the handgun training courses. What is it that people won't be taught, assuming that some people don't take these courses in the future since they won't have to get a permit? I'm just wondering what it is that certain unidentifiable population of people who won't take courses anymore will be missing out on. And I was just wondering if maybe you could explain the sort of the minimum state requirements of the handgun training courses that exist right now.
Madam Chair, Representative Guerra, I believe that the existing courses go over handling of firearms, go over loading, unloading, go over the state laws, and there is also under existing law a competency requirement, fairly minimal, but there is a competency requirement.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian. I think we got the answer there. Okay. With that, Brian, if you could just hang online. I do have one other person that's come online in Kenai, Mr. Rod Christopher from the, looks like, Peninsula Weapons Academy. Mr. Christopher.
Yes, my name is Rod Christopher, and I do own Peninsula Weapons Academy in Soldotna. It's a firearm school. And I've been a weapons instructor over 20 years. And I've inspected law enforcement, military, and the private sector. But I have people who come into my CCW classes who have never held a gun before in their life. They're mostly females, a few males, but mostly females. They want to carry it for protection. Now, the NRA Personal Protection Course is a basic handgun course. It teaches you handling, it teaches you first and foremost safety, about ammunition, how to load, unload the gun, how to be safe with it. And it allows them to shoot the weapon and develop a knowledge of how it feels and how to shoot it. And also the law is very important. I have a problem with turning people loose on the street who don't know when to shoot and when not to shoot. In other words, when to use deadly force and when not to. It would be silly to put people on the street with no weapons knowledge and no knowledge of deadly force, and especially no knowledge of how to safely handle that weapon, which what is taught in this class. I think it's a grave mistake to turn people loose with a firearm on the street with no training. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Christopher, I have a question. You heard the line of questioning that Representative Guerra was going down and then the response from Mr. Judy. So under state law right now, if you are carrying a weapon openly, you aren't required to go through any training and you're not required to have a competency requirement or a familiarity with state laws. So would your statements indicate that you would be more supportive of when you carry openly you ought to have those requirements? Or if the answer is no, what is it about carrying a concealed weapon that in your mind obligates the individual to have a better knowledge of the law, a better knowledge of handling, loading, and unloading, and competency?
Well, it's just common sense that you should have all of these when carrying a weapon. And not only that, if you get into a gunfight, God forbid, and you do use deadly force, and you do kill somebody, that concealed carry permit is used as an affirmative defense for you in court.
We're about to change all that in our other bill. But in just getting back, Mr. Christopher, to what I'm really trying to say is, this committee hearing isn't about whether we should have gun safety for classes for all permit holders of guns, all people who carry weapons, I should say, because we already know that under Alaska state law, those people that carry their weapons openly aren't required to go through training, a competency examination, or a familiarity with state laws. So now what we're trying to understand is why, again, if you're testifying against this bill, why should we as a state have those types of requirements for someone who's a concealed carry permit holder when we don't require it for the large group of people who carry openly?
Well, you know, I can't answer that question because I don't know why we don't. I think we should.
Okay, fair enough. Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Mr. Christopher, this is Representative Guerra speaking. You had mentioned, I guess I had thought about the safety aspects of the courses, but I hadn't thought about the part of the courses where you teach people the law as to when you're allowed to shoot in defense of yourself. And now, I guess I'm wondering, I mean, I somewhat see that as a common sense issue, but have you had students in your courses who thought they were allowed to shoot at somebody in cases where they weren't allowed to shoot? Is that something that has happened in your experience, that you've taught people that they otherwise didn't know?
Absolutely. Almost every class I've had, and I've been teaching this class since the beginning, they are not aware of the acronym JAM, which is Jeopardy, Ability, and Means. They think if somebody breaks into your house, you can automatically shoot them, and that's not true. And this is what I'm trying to prevent.
Thank you, Mr. Christopher.
Okay. Well, Mr. Christopher, I'll say the same thing I said to the others. I appreciate you taking the time out of your day to come down and testify before House Judiciary.
Got it.
And with that, that brings us, I'm going to go ahead and, is there anyone in the audience I missed? Anyone online that I've missed? Okay. With that, public testimony is closed. That brings us back to the bill before us. And Representative Samuels.
Yeah, I move that we adopt the CS for HB 102Q version.
Thank you. Hearing any objection? Nope. Okay, so that's before us. That was a technicality that we had to deal with. So now we have the State Affairs version Q before us. Is there any debate from committee members? Any final statements from Representative Croft?
Gina,
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess this is a question for the sponsor of the bill.
Me.
I guess in deciding whether or not to prevent, to waive the requirement that people get a permit, we have to decide how burdensome that is for somebody to get a permit. So if you could give us your best shot at what the burden is of upon the public that you feel is unjustified under current law, I'd appreciate it.
Representative Croft?
I think the burden is medium. It's you have to attend the course and the training. It can be a significant time burden. You know, somebody that did not feel threatened but has reason to now, There have been instances nationwide where somebody has been assaulted on the thing they were worried about, waiting in the time delay it takes to get that concealed carry permit. So a medium burden, I would rather leave it up to the individual. And I think if I was going to do any summation on this, there are reasonable people on both sides of this issue. I'm not saying that this is a totally black and white one. But I do believe that it comes down to a fundamental ideological, if you will, definition on who do you trust. The Mr. Christopher, who teaches the course and thinks, and I've ran across, again, other very reasonable, well-intentioned people who think that ought to be a general requirement of gun ownership, some in the legislature, actually, that we ought to have a general governmental requirement of training before you purchase a gun and a government list of who has it. And I just fundamentally come down on the opposite side of the equation.
Representative Guerra?
I've got no further questions. I've got no further questions. I suppose I wouldn't mind having just a few minutes of discussion.
Absolutely. I have one curiosity, Representative Crawford. I haven't read the case law on it, but I'm curious. Vanessa and I were talking about this a couple of days ago, that I'm certain that there was a point in case law where we made the shift between your fundamental Second Amendment right to carry arms and the distinction between your right to conceal it. I don't know the answer, but I suspect that there was some trend or a case out there that said, yes, you have a Second Amendment right, but when put up against the state's right for public protection or so on, that the right to conceal it is not absolute, and that there will be qualifiers that a state can place upon that, and I just don't know it, but I'd be interested to hear what discussion, if any.
Yeah, I don't know of any constitutional cases on whether the carrying concealed is a fundamental right. And I'm pretty sure there haven't been any cases since we changed our Constitution to clarify that ours is an individual right. There's this ongoing debate under the Second Amendment whether it's a militia governmental right or an individually held. I think the reason there's so little case law on the line you're talking about, and I'll look again for it, is because there's this continuing question under federal law whether it even applies, whether it's even an enforceable right. Some courts hold that it is, some don't. It's the very reason we clarified ours to be an individual right, and I don't think it's been challenged since we did that in 96.
And then just in follow-up, what was the rationale then behind this legislature's intent at some point in time to say, yes, you have a right to carry a weapon, and for those general categories of carrying openly, we won't require you to go through training and so on. But for the specific category of concealed weapons, it's different in some way, and so we as a state are going to impose limitations. Do you happen to know what the rationale was when that law went into effect?
I don't, and we can look some more. I think it's one of those things that that has been sort of accepted and not questioned much over the 19th century, and there's, I think, Vermont starting it's easy just to have things that you're used to. It's a distinction that we're used to. I don't think it has been as rigorously thought through as it should be, and that's part of this process.
Okay. Any further discussion? Representative Guerra?
Is there a motion?
Not yet.
Are you just doing it on?
We're just letting everybody talk real quick, and then we'll have one here soon. Representative Samuels is going to make the motion.
No, I suppose I'll just state that I have concerns about this bill that I didn't have about the handgun bill that we voted on the House floor today, and I voted in favor of that bill today, the reciprocity bill, on the floor today, but I don't think that I'm going to be able to support this one. The point that Mr. Judy makes, and actually that Representative Croft makes, which is that there are no good statistics at this point that would show that passing this bill would make Alaska a more dangerous place, I think is a good one. I mean, I think we don't have statistics that show that, and so I consider that sort of mightily in looking at this bill. But on the other hand, the point that Mr. Christopher makes is that maybe we don't know that there are a lot of people out there that would be more dangerous with a handgun with this bill than without this bill. But it seems like there will be some certain number of people who think that they can use a handgun in circumstances they shouldn't use a handgun to defend themselves. It seems like there will be some number of people who would benefit from a gun safety course. Maybe those people aren't large enough in number that they'll make a statistical blip, but I think they exist. And so right now I think I side with the view that Mr. Christopher has espoused. That's my level of discomfort, I guess, right now with the bill.
And I'll just say, for me, I know I've had a lot of questions to Brian, and I think just wanting to understand the question I just asked again, and I haven't been able to get an answer. Whenever you change a policy that's like this, it's nice to know why the policy existed to begin with. But I haven't been able to put my fingers on any, as Representative Garris said, statistical evidence or other kind of evidence that says that someone who carries a concealed weapon is more likely to perpetuate violence or is more likely to be a risk, and so on. And so that's where I come down and saying I support it. When we started down the road, there was some apprehension on my part in believing that there must have been a reason behind it. And not being familiar with what that reason was, I wanted to explore it. I do think it's been an interesting philosophical debate when we look at other areas of the law, as I mentioned, driver's license, in that there are two routes a state can take. They can say individuals should know that they can't drive if they're 16, and they should know that they can't drive if they're not competent, and they should just know it. So why do we waste time testing them? Why do we waste time forcing them to read handbooks and so on? An interesting analogy to your right to bear arms, but I guess it's different, you know, when you look at it as a constitutional right versus a privilege of driving. So ultimately, that's where I've come full circle on the bill, but I think it's been really interesting debate, and I want to thank all the people from Kenai, and thank you to Brian for being patient as we work through the bill. And with that, is there anything else I've missed? Representative Samuels.
I move CS for HB 102 with individual recommendations attached. Zero fiscal note.
Any objection? Hearing no objection, House Bill number 102 is moved.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Kraft. Now, we have before us a real small, easy bill, huh? We have back before us Representative Williams. Is he going to come in person, or are you going to be here? Okay. We have, if you'll recall, committee, it's been a couple of weeks since we've had this bill before us, House Bill number 31 and its companion, H.J.R. 5. If you recall, the testimony on this bill centered largely around, I think Representative Guerra made good points with respect to what burden were you placing on initiative process in general and the folks that have to get the signatures, costs, and other things. I think I heard Representative Samuels and Representative Anderson make comments with respect to if we're all one state, then ought we not have some sort of proportional representation from the rest of the state. And that was sort of my line of thinking as well, was that we are trying to heal an urban-rural divide as it is in many other areas, and even though it costs more to reach out to rural areas, we still do it. So maybe we ought to be doing it in this area as well. And then we heard from folks in the Anchorage LIO and some other LIOs who testified, and then I don't have anyone else right now. I didn't close public testimony, but I don't have any people signed up. So I'll just ask, there is somebody in the audience, then if you want to come forward, let's continue to wrap up public testimony. And if there's somebody online We'll get to you in just a second here, and then we'll go to committee testimony.
Okay. Hi. Thanks for allowing me to speak again. My name is Alvin Anders, 217 Seward Street in Juneau. I'm chair of the Alaska Libertarian Party of Juneau and secretary of the Libertarian Party statewide. You may recall I testified earlier that this bill should be opposed because, first of all, it's unnecessary, and secondly, it doesn't accomplish what the proponents want it to do. It's unnecessary because the initiative process is working fine. It's helping to increase turnout. It's increasing voter registrations in the state, and it's allowing citizens to decide very contentious issues, which are such as the bill we just considered, the right to keep and bear arms. The Libertarian Party would like to do that as an initiative to give Alaska the right to make concealed carry permits optional. We'd like to do it through the initiative process.
We may not need to.
We may not. We hope not. But it's just one of the examples. This the initiative process cuts both ways. Both liberal and conservative issues are placed on the ballot by citizens who are interested in effecting reform. It doesn't accomplish what the sponsors want it to do because, well, first of all, assuming that what the sponsors really want to do is to include more of the state in the initiative process and not act as a veto on issues that they don't want to see on the ballot, then a better way to accomplish that is, as I mentioned before, make the initiative one page so it can be posted on the internet, downloaded as Adobe Acrobat file, signed and printed, and then mailed in. And what I have is a copy of how we use the initiative process in Anchorage and other areas around the state. Works just fine. The citizens are their signatures are still checked to make sure that they are registered voters. And by making it one page instead of a booklet, it makes it easier for folks in the hinterlands to fill out the form, mail it in, without feeling that they have to get 150 signatures to turn in their petition booklet. So that reform can be done without having to do a constitutional amendment, which will have the Republican Party in the position of at a time of rapid budget cuts and austere budget decisions, being in the position of being seen as opposing the initiative process. We would like to see the committee vote against it. I think one of the reasons why the very good reform that was supported by Ken Jacobus and the Republican Party instant runoff voting failed in the 2002 election was because it was seen by the Republican Party as an effort to take control of the legislature by tinkering with the political process. Voters were already upset with the Republicans for the closed primary, and then they saw the instant runoff voting is just another way that the Republicans were trying to seize control of the state. It was a good reform. It should have passed. I hope it does. It gets another chance. And again, this type of reform is the way to go. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks and pass this around to have it viewed by anyone who wants to look at it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Anders. Appreciate your testimony today and appreciate it 2 weeks ago. I think you make good points. With that, is there anyone else in the audience that I have overlooked? Is there anyone else online for House Bill number 31 and HJR 5? Okay, with that, public testimony is closed on those two pieces of legislation. And so that brings the two bills before us for committee discussion. Representative Ogg.
If you wish me to move those, I'm happy to move. You want to move one at a time or both?
Yes. I don't believe they're going to.
Why don't we start with House Bill 31 and then we can object for discussion?
Move House Bill number 31.
Thank you, Representative Ogg. And there was an objection noted by Representative Guerra. Representative Guerra.
Are we on /D, Kurtz?
That's correct. On /. That's correct. So just for the Madam Secretary's clarification, we are on /D Kurtz dated 4703, House Bill number 31. It's been moved. There's an objection by Representative Guerra. Representative Guerra, speaking to your objection.
I'm not going to talk about my objections to the bill as a matter of substance. I have many of those objections. It seems pretty clear to me that we're changing the Constitution, and you can't do that with a House bill. The Constitution says that all you need is one signature from voters who reside in two-thirds of the districts throughout the state, and ultimately you need a certain number of signatures total. This bill makes the signature requirement much more difficult. It defeats the intent, I believe, of the framers of our Constitution, and I believe the bill would just be sent back to us as unconstitutional. It'll cost us a lot of money in court costs, and I just don't think we should pass a bill that is pretty clearly unconstitutional.
Thank you, Representative Guerra. And Representative Ogg, my apologies to you. I had the two CSs on top, and I'm told that we are not doing the CSs. We just need to move the original House Bill 31. My apologies. Can you make a motion to rescind your action?
And Madam Chair, actually, on the constitutional question, I understand that the legislative counsel who wrote the constitutional opinion on this bill is in attendance, and I guess I wouldn't mind asking her a couple questions.
Could we just get done with this technicality here real quick? Representative Ogg, if you could just make a motion to rescind your action. Okay. Any objection? Hearing none. Now, Representative Ogg, your new motion.
The motion is the original. I don't have it in front of me.
Okay. So the motion is to move House Bill number 31. Okay.
Object.
There's an object. That's correct. That's right. For the people in the audience and online, we apologize, but our packets for this are very thick, so there are a bunch of different versions floating around. So, Madam Secretary, we have a motion on the table to move House Bill number 31. Its original version, which is /A, there was an objection by Representative Guerra.
To adopt it.
To adopt.
Right.
To move it. We've already adopted it. It's already automatically before us. It's a House bill. So the motion was to move it. There's an objection. Representative Guerra asked if he could have
Ms. Kurtz
come before us. Welcome, Catherine.
My name's Catherine Kurtz, and I am a drafting attorney with Ledge Legal.
Ms. Kurtz, I guess it's pretty clear what I think about this, but I guess I'm interested in what you think about the bill and whether it's constitutional or not. I know you've done an analysis of HB 31, and I guess I'd like to hear your opinion whether or not you think the bill is constitutional.
My sense is that the bill adds an additional requirement for initiative petitions above and beyond what is specified in the Constitution, and I think that is a potential vulnerability of the bill, that you might find that this bill is subject to legal challenge, and I can't call with certainty how a court would decide the issue, but I think there's a good chance that it's vulnerable. So without a constitutional amendment, there is a potential weakness here.
I guess I would ask you
that.
Certainly, most bills are vulnerable to a challenge. The question is whether the challenge is going to be successful. And I guess if I were asking you, as somebody who were sitting in a seat, on a judge's seat, how you would rule based on the information you have, would you say that it's more likely than not that this bill would be unconstitutional, or would you not?
I would.
You would.
And then just to interject briefly, that's why we do have, and it's sort of difficult because we're bifurcating, they're two different bills, but that is why we have House Joint Resolution number 5, which would be proposing an amendment to the Constitution. So just to be clear, Ms. Kurtz, we did receive your memo on the subject and appreciate your opinion, and I don't disagree. So that is why we have the House Joint Resolution number 5 following behind it that would actually make the amendment. I think there's no question that you have to amend both the statute and the Constitution in this issue. So I don't disagree, Representative Guerra. Any further questions, Representative Guerra?
I have no further questions.
Thank you, Ms. Kurtz. Okay, with that, that brings us back to the original motion regarding House Bill number 31. Representative Guerra, do you maintain your objection?
I do.
Okay, any further discussion? Hearing none, Madam Secretary, will you please call the roll?
Representative Samuels?
Yes.
Representative Guerra?
No.
Representative Gruenberg is absent. Representative Anderson?
Yes.
Representative Ogg?
Yes.
Representative Holm?
Yes.
Representative McGuire?
Yes.
5-1.
And so, House Bill number 31 carries and is moved out of this committee. That brings us, Representative Ogg.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to move House Joint Resolution number 5, which is identified as /A.
Okay, any objection?
Yeah.
Representative Guerra, would you like to speak to your objection, or have you already?
I think I will speak to it. This is a very important issue, and I know we discussed this bill quite a bit at a prior hearing, but I've now heard all of the points made in favor of changing the initiative process, and I want to state for the record why I disagree. First of all, by changing the Constitution, make no mistake about it, we're taking away people's constitutional rights. We're limiting their constitutional rights, and I think we should only do that when there's an incredibly compelling reason to do it. I've heard no incredibly compelling reason to change the Constitution and to limit people's rights. By making the requirement much more difficult, by making it more burdensome to collect signatures, all we do is preserve the initiative process for people who have a lot of money. This bill only harms people who don't have a lot of money, who don't have the staff to go out to 27 different districts to gain 500 or 1,000 signatures in each one of those districts. And I think what we heard is, in order to get an initiative on the ballot, you have to go to each one of those districts and get roughly 150% or 200% of the signatures you need, because many of those signatures will be disqualified. So we're telling people that in order to exercise their constitutional right to put an initiative on the ballot, they have to go to 27 different districts. They probably have to get 1,000 signatures in each of those districts. And that is just a burden that only the wealthiest will be able to effectively deal with. And so today, if we pass this out of committee, what we're saying, I believe, is that the initiative process should be reserved only to those who have the most money. That's not the intention. I know that's not the intention of the sponsor behind the bill. I know that's not the intention of the members of the committee, but that will be the effect. We will preserve the initiative process just for the wealthiest. I think that's a bad idea. I think the right to direct democracy is an incredibly important one. It might be the most important right that people have in this state, the right to take a matter into their own hands and put it on the ballot. The point has been made that it's not fair to people who live outside of Anchorage to have initiatives placed on the ballot under the way the Constitution is written today. It is fair because ultimately it doesn't matter how many signatures you get from various districts. The question is, will the majority of Alaskans vote for an initiative at the ballot? That's democracy. That's how it works. When we pass a bill in this committee, we don't need 2/3 of all representatives to approve of a bill before it reaches the House floor. Well, actually, there is this sort of majority of the majority rule that's appeared this year, but that's not in the Constitution. I don't think that we have to require that something pass muster with 2/3 of the members of this body before it gets voted on. It just gets voted on, and that's how it should be. So that's democracy. You present an issue, you let it get voted upon. Often the vote goes the opposite way that you would like it to go, but that's no reason to take away the right of people to participate in a democracy. I think 50% of the time we should expect that people will vote the opposite way that we would want to vote. So I think that's the benefit and the burden of democracy. I can't support this resolution.
Thank you, Representative Guerra. Representative Holm and then Ogg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With all due respect to the good representative on my left, the preservation of one folks' right at the expense of another set of folks' rights, I think it's in jeopardy here if we do not pass this. The state of Alaska is a very unique situation, unlike almost any other place in the United States. In fact, unlike any other place in the United States, since we have a tremendous amount of the population, approximately half of it, in one area. And by so doing, they could pass laws that affect the people that live in the bush, the people that live in the southeast, and all over the state, that adversely affects their livelihood just because there are a group of folks in one area that maybe don't agree with their lifestyle, their culture, or whatever. Representative Guerra, we live and we are governed in a country that is a representative republic, not a democracy. And I have to point this out to you because the difference between a representative republic and a democracy is that the tyranny of the majority is somewhat abated, that we try to make sure that the majority cannot act in an unruly manner to subject the minority to its whims. And so I think it's not unreasonable that we request or we require that people who are going to be affected by laws and things that we do here or initiatives or initiative process they need to have a seat at the table. And I think this allows them to have a seat at the table. That if we don't go out to them and we don't request that those folks have a part of that initiative process when it will adversely affect their livelihood or their culture or their ability to live as they see fit, I think we're doing a grave injustice. And so I suppose that this debate will go on for the next 200 years, but this debate's been going on since Marbury versus Madison, and you can go back and there are so many, many different historical aspects of this debate. But we are a representative republic. We have an initiative process which allows the people to change the process, but we cannot keep the people out of the process who will be adversely affected. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Holm. Representative Ogg.
Yes, I would just echo Representative Holm's comments, so I won't repeat those, but I would like to point out to the representative from downtown Anchorage that we're actually moving in a direction that exercises the democracy in its truest form. This is submitted to the voters, and this won't happen until it goes before them. So we're just suggesting to them that this would be a good direction to go. If they see fit with our thoughts, then it will become a fact of our Constitution. If not, the people will have spoken.
Great point. Representative Samuels or Anderson? Nothing? Everybody is good for Representative Guerra.
Just in closing, it's a fair point that Representative Ogg makes. Certainly with the bill that just passed out of committee, we are taking people's rights away without asking them their permission, but with the constitutional version, the resolution, I suppose we are asking their permission before they give up their rights. It's a fair point. I suppose if this body is going to take away people's constitutional rights or take away their rights in any way, I suppose it is better policy to ask their permission. I still think it's bad policy for the reasons I stated.
Thank you, Representative Guerra. And I want to thank all the members, both today and the time that we had it up before. I think some of the more interesting discussions in this committee and everybody speaking from their heart and from their logic in really good ways. So I appreciate all the debate and respect everybody's points that they've made. With that, we still have a motion on the table for the passage of House Joint Resolution Number 5. Representative Guerra, do you maintain your objection? And so, Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
Representative Guerra.
No.
Representative Gruber is absent. Representative Anderson.
Yes.
Representative Ogg.
Yes.
Representative Holm.
Yes.
Representative Samuels.
Yes.
Representative McGuire.
Yes.
5-1.
And so, House Joint Resolution Number 5 moves. With that, that brings us to House Bill Number 86, Representative Fate and Jim Pound. Jim, welcome to Judiciary Committee.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Representative Fate is chairing the Resources Committee at the present.
We understand. Thank you for being here in his absence.
With your dulcimer tone, sir. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm on a losing streak, and I was hoping maybe we could continue this committee till another day when things might go better.
Okay. Okay. And I don't have anybody signed up or anybody online, so speak up if you're out there online and we don't catch you, and as well for the folks in the room if you want to speak on House Bill number 86. Mr. Pound.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. Sponsor substitute for House Bill 86 is a rewrite of the intent of the original House Bill 86, which you also have in your packet, in order for it to meet constitutional muster. As written, it approaches the issue of asking for and receiving injunctions that delay work on already permitted projects. Under current law, if a plaintiff files for an injunction against the project and ultimately loses in court, they ultimately end up being responsible for part of the court costs and part of the attorney fees for the defendant. The language in the bill will guide the judiciary, but leaves the determinations of their decision still up to the bench. SS for House Bill 86 makes those who improperly seek and cause an injunction responsible for the full court costs and attorney fees. It also adds language to the statute that require that the cost incurred as a result of the delay will be paid for by the responsible party. Those costs include wages and salaries for employees working on the project, material costs, penalties, and interest on contracts associated with the project. When a project is permitted, a contractor goes to work, hiring employees, purchasing materials. These are commitments that a contractor makes. An improper delay of a project costs more than just court costs and attorney fees. It disrupts the lives of the contractor, his or her employees, and those other subcontractors who do the work. It is unreasonable for someone to have an effect on this many lives without bearing some of the true costs. Essentially, SS for House Bill 86 means the responsible party will have to be responsible. We urge your support of House Bill 86. I'll be able to answer any questions, and I believe you may have a potential amendment in front of you as well.
Okay, I don't see that yet. When Vanessa comes back, she's getting something for me. I do, and we'll just kind of work through this. I'm looking at page 1, line 10, when you say the phrase bad faith legal challenge. Are you referring to Rule 11? Is that the standard that will be in law?
Primarily what we are leaving the term bad faith is to every time I've gone through looking for bad faith, a lot of it comes up in insurance law, and it seems like every judge has a different definition for what is bad faith or what isn't bad faith, and we're leaving that to the discretion of the bench.
Okay, because you are aware of Rule 11, which sets up that standard. And so you're saying you want to leave it up to the discretion of the judge. Okay, and then, these are some of the notes. Okay, and then when is the bad faith to be determined under the bill? Is it pretrial motions? At what stage in the litigation?
I would believe that in the most cases, it'll actually be determined with the final decision by the judge or by the jury because it'll fall under the substantially prevail situation.
Okay. Representative Ogg, any questions?
Well, I probably have numerous questions. Some were yours on the bad faith, but the question was why does not the present court rules that deal with frivolous lawsuits cover this issue?
Primarily, in the trend through the chair, Representative Ogg, primarily, the trend has been only to deal with partial existing court rules, allow for partial court costs and partial attorney fees, and does not, and under this type of language in a construction type project, allow for any other payment back to the defendant in the case.
Representative Ogg?
And the second thing is the standard of says substantially prevail. somebody could prevail. If they didn't reach the height of substantially prevailing, they could be a winner but a loser.
Again, through the chair, Representative Boggs, that is another one of the terms, sort of like bad faith, where a lot of it is going through and doing research on trying to find the exact definition of substantially prevail. Really depends on the particular court and the particular judge. Give me just a second, if you would.
excuse me.
About the best definition I could come up with came out of the U.S. Fifth Circuit Court. A plaintiff may be considered a prevailing party, which they do reference back to substantially prevail, if they succeed on any significant issue of litigation in which achieves some of the benefits that the party sought in bringing the suit.
I wouldn't.
Representative Vaughn?
Through the chair. So you don't, you feel that just prevailing is not high enough, that you need to have a higher standard here.
Through the chair, Representative Vaughn, I believe we need to have a higher standard in order to, you know, to spell out what the legislative intent is that we want, essentially what we want to do is to eliminate a lot of the frivolous suits and a lot of the frivolous injunctions that may have been granted before they're ever, before the process has ever started. Hopefully this will eliminate some of the backlog in courts, for one. And by giving it a substantially prevail, there's still a presumption on behalf and allowing the courts to make a decision of what substantially prevail means.
Representative Buck?
Confused. And now you're saying so that you could avoid the frivolous ones, but I thought that the point of when it is that it has no value, and then there are penalties for the people who bring one. But it seems like you have another standard. I'm getting a little confused when you bring those two together. Here, that substantially prevails allows somebody to. Lost me there a little bit.
Frivolous lawsuits fall into one category, which presently allows for partial court costs and partial attorney fees. What we are primarily dealing with here is a situation of where a group or an individual looks at a permitted project, and the key word here is permitted. In other words, it has gone through the entire public process. It has gone through all the hoops, so to speak, to get all the permits they need. An example would be in the interior when they were planning to build the intertie from the Healy Coal Project up to Fairbanks. Had gone through all the permits and all the projects. Somebody came in with a lawsuit saying it's an eyesore and received an injunction and held that project up for almost a year and a half with multi-million dollars involved in attorney's fees, in people not being able to work on the project, people who had committed. I mean, this goes all the way down to the basic laborer who, you know, basically said, yeah, I'll go to work for you, and then suddenly realizes he doesn't have a job. She doesn't have a job because the project that they were going to work on and committed to, you know, isn't there anymore. And so, while it may not be in the injunction process considered a frivolous lawsuit, it may be after the entire hearing, a judge may look at the basic information through the injunction process, say that an injunction is granted, and then come back to find out later on that there was no reason to have had an injunction and the project shouldn't have been stopped in the first place, at which point the defendant in the actual case has been delayed for a year and a half. He has substantial attorney fees, substantial court costs, plus he or she is probably already, because he figured the project was going to continue, made commitments to subcontractors, individuals, material companies, and so on and so forth, that he or she is still paying for. Paying interest on.
Representative Vaughn?
In that example, that was determined to have been a frivolous injunction, a frivolous action, or not?
I am, through the chair, Representative, I am not that familiar with that particular case. I apologize for citing that one, but that just happened to be the one that came to mind. I haven't researched the case, but I do know that project is now moving forward, but it was a year and a half delayed. And I believe that all the company got out of it was attorney's fees and court costs.
Little B just slipped me a note that makes a very good point, which is that Rule 11 deals with sanctions against attorneys for frivolous filings, not plaintiffs. And so the goal of your bill is to try to get at the plaintiffs themselves. Representative Anderson and then Guerra.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I was looking at the arguments for this, and certainly an injunction could delay a project. I think that was the intent of your of bringing this legislation, and that injunction would then slow down development and economic growth. You could extrapolate that out. I think that's why you have the co-sponsors you do, because on face value they said, oh, bad faith legal challenge, delays a project, let's prevent that. That sounds good. I'm not questioning their co-sponsorship. I can see the merit, again, on face value. I also think that a person would be less likely to unjustly pursue, delaying a project with this law. But conversely, to me, the kind of the antithesis of that is that it would discourage a person from seeking an injunction against the state permanent project. And I look at kind of the expansion, as Representative Ogg noted, in bad faith legal challenge, it confused the chair and myself. Rule 11, what rule are you talking about? And when you drafted it, I'm sure you had the intent, hey, bad faith, its merits, we understand what that means, but it comes into question, especially in this committee. I think it's ripe to bring that up, that definition, because that term is used in so many other, ways. And so, assuming that these injunctions produce results that are beneficial sometimes to the public, I think we have to be careful that we don't discourage people from seeking an injunction. And to that, the damages provided on page 2, I think line 6 are fairly expansive. And when you look at that, it opens the door to basically any cost or damage proven to be linked to the injunction. And I guess I would caution, again, there's merit in the intent, so we prevent people from doing this. But Representative Gere, we've all talked about these issues where we don't want it to be so prohibitive that folks say, well, I'm scared to do this. But what if they think it's bad faith? It isn't bad faith, but, this bill that Representative Fate passed years ago never defined what bad faith is. I guess it would be more just a comment than a question, unless you have a response to.
Again, through the chair, I think essentially the bad faith argument, again, we see it a lot in insurance law, or insurance case law. And I think by leaving that definition up to the bench, I think we're far better off than trying to second guess and let it become precedent in case law unto itself.
Well, then just real quick, I know Representative Gere has comments too, just on that point, then why don't we just make it a discretionary to the judge to award damages as well? So the defining of bad faith is discretion, and then the awarding of damages is discretionary too. Why do we have it as shall be liable?
I believe that, Representative Moore, I believe there's essentially what we have right now, it's discretionary, but it's specified under rules and is limited to court costs,
right,
and attorney's fees. And this expands beyond the court costs and attorney fees.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I have a number of concerns. One is that the bill is confusing, apart from the substance. And for one, the bill says that you should not be allowed to file a bad faith injunction. And that's a fair point. But and I'll share this with other members of the committee. I asked legislative counsel to share with me the standards that you must meet before you can get an injunction or a preliminary injunction in the first place. And injunctions are rarely granted, and the issue of whether or not a claim is frivolous or not is always dealt with in an injunction case at the outset. I'll just read briefly from page 3 of the memo that I received from Ms. Kurtz, and I'll pass it around. But in order to get a preliminary injunction, one of the things you have to show is, and this is quoted from a case, an Alaska case, the plaintiff must raise serious and substantial questions going to the merits of the case, that is, issues raised cannot be frivolous or obviously without merit. So before you can get an injunction, before a court will come in and tell somebody they can't do anything pending the outcome of a trial, the court already imposes a heightened standard. And the court already says this better not be a frivolous claim, and there's a hearing on that. So I'm not exactly sure what the need for the bill is. Under this bill, I suppose, the court would make this determination at the outset. The court would say this better not be a frivolous claim. They have a hearing to make sure that there's merit to the claim. And then under this bill, apparently the defendant gets to take a second bite at the apple later on and say, now I want another hearing as to whether or not the claim was frivolous. It seems like the protection is already there. On that point, I mean, have you considered that point, the need to change existing law?
Through the chair, Representative McGarrah, essentially that's correct. But the reality of it is when it's all said and done, the judge looks at the defendant and says, we'll award you part of your attorney's fees and part of your court costs.
And that, the second point, I mean, I think I could actually, I could agree with what you wanted. I think what you want is already in the law, though. I think what you want is something that says, you know, partial attorney's fees don't do me any good if somebody filed a frivolous claim against me and they got an injunction. I would agree with that. And then I think you should be entitled to full attorney's fees. I think you already are under Rule 11 and Rule 82, the way the courts interpret it. I think they've said that when a claim is frivolous, you can award full attorney's fees against the party that was wronged, that did the wrong. So if that's all your bill did, which was that it granted full attorney's fees when an injunction was improperly obtained, though it's sort of circular whether an injunction can properly be obtained on a frivolous claim in the first place, because it looks like you have to clear that hurdle with the court first. But assuming you can get a frivolous injunction, that seems very unlikely to me, but assuming you can, sure, and let's give you full attorney's fees. But here's the bigger concern I have with the bill. The bill says you don't just get full attorney's fees. It says you can also charge the plaintiff for all your lost profits during the time the injunction was in place. And if you got rid of all those other remedies and just said it's full attorney's fees, I think I'd sign off on this bill right now and I'd say let's send it to the next committee. But I worry about the real-world examples, which are, for example, there's a gas lease off the Kenai River. And a bunch of fishermen get together and they say that's really a bad idea and we think the gas lease is illegal and they get an injunction. And they get the injunction and the court says, yeah, that looks like a good faith claim. It looks like you're going to win. I'll give you the injunction. The injunction is there for 2 years. It turns out the plaintiff is wrong. They lose on a technical ground. They lose on a substantive ground. Who knows why they lose, but they ultimately lose. And now they've cost the oil company God knows how many millions worth of dollars. I mean, you said in the Fairbanks case, multi-millions of dollars were lost in the meantime. So now we're going to say to an average person, a fisherman, or just an average person, before you file for an injunction against a large corporation, we're going to tell you that you might be liable for millions of dollars before you do it. And actually, under Rule 65, which I just passed around, you've actually got to post a bond. You've got to post $1 million or multi-million dollar bond before you file this lawsuit. Can you do that? And all of a sudden, we're just leaving injunction law available to the richest of people, and we're knocking 95% of Alaskans out of the mix. So I guess on that issue, I mean, why is that good policy?
Well, through the chair, Representative Garrett, I would turn it around. I'll use the fisherman case. You're a fisherman. You're a commercial fisherman. You own a boat. You have boat payments. You have house payments. You have crew that works for you. And a group comes in and says, well, you know, your net might catch a seal, so therefore you're not going to be able to fish this year. All right? And they get an injunction against you to fish, not to fish. So you lose the entire season, and you spend your entire fishing season when you should be out on the water with your crew in court. You've hired an attorney, you have court costs, but you also lost all your income for the year. So why shouldn't you not be able to, if it was a frivolous case, why should you not be allowed to recover your loss?
Well, I guess if you told me that in that case, if we could write a law that said in that case you can get the remedies you have in this bill, but in the other case, when you're trying to get them against the fishermen and you're the oil company, and you wouldn't apply this bill, I'd be okay with that. But the reality is, to apply it in your case, you also have to apply it in my case. And by passing this bill, it's going to be a bill of general applicability. It will be used by the large oil companies to scare a fisherman out of court in the first place.
Representative, Madam Chair, I'm not inclined to say that the large oil companies won't use this. I'm also not inclined to say that ultimately what happens is you have a situation of where, for lack of a, we'll call it VECO, for lack of a better term, who basically is an oil service company, and I hate to bring that company's name into it in general, but an oil service company who turns around and subcontracts to another company, who turns around and subcontracts to another company, who ultimately hires an employee, all under some form of a contract, that once that project is stopped at the largest area, it has a trickle-down effect to where it ultimately ends up that the people that are hurt are not just the large corporations, they're actually the small individual who's just wants to go to work.
Along this line, just
okay,
one more
briefly,
question.
And then let's, and we'll all sure. keep discussing. There are other people that want to speak. Representative Guerra.
Do you have any evidence that too many injunctions, too many frivolous injunctions are being granted today?
Sure.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I have no specific, but this is also a preventative. We have many large projects that are getting ready to start in this state in the next 4 years that certainly the potential is going to increase as we start looking at resource development in the state.
Representative Samuels and then Holm. Welcome to Judiciary.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I don't know
where
you
to.
You guys just let me win one.
I couldn't write fast enough to write them all down. First of all, it's not the lost profits. It's the lost operating expense also. If you hire an entire camp at a construction camp and shut a road project down, you're still paying these people off. If you're not paying them, then you're hurting the employees either. So you should do what's right or wrong. You shouldn't worry about whether it is ExxonMobil or whether it is Ralph Samuels' little construction company. It's the right thing to do. If somebody's attempting to file an injunction that they know is wrong, they know it's in bad faith, they talk a judge into it, the judge gives them the injunction, and the judge comes back when all the evidence is seen and said, gosh, he should have known better, well, then he should be punished. And I shouldn't lose, whether I'm a fisherman or an oil company or whatever kind of person I am, I shouldn't have to cough up the money for all of my employees, all of my expenses, and all I get is the attorney fees back. Well, that's break even for me. If it's 2 years, I'm out of business. It's so unfair that it's almost mind-boggling.
I wish I could respond, but it's not my turn.
you can respond in a minute.
Representative Baum.
I'll just bring up. I heard some statements here that just almost made me jump out of my chair. No frivolous lawsuits. My God, man, we had a permitted Golden Valley Electric Association had a permitted right-of-way, completely permitted, across the Tanana Flats. And because somebody didn't think that they wanted to take a look at those lines going across the flats, they sued, and they cost $7 million and 9 years of reduced cost or greater cost in electrical power to the people of the interior of Alaska. There was no penalty. There were no charges for attorney's fees. There was no reimbursement whatsoever. And some judge, someplace, who knows where, they come out of every greeny spot in the world and files and come up with these ideas where we can just stop projects. I mean, snail darter, do we remember any of these things? I can go on and on and on about issues like this, which it maybe don't have anything in particular with this. But we know numerous cases of this. I think Mr. Anderson was wrong. Representative Anderson was wrong. I think this is for the purpose of reducing lawsuits. The United States of America has 2% of its gross national product in the legal profession, sir. You're more concerned about preserving the profits of attorneys And I'm worried about preserving the profits
of
others.
I'm going to object, actually. It's on a point of personal privilege.
Oh, no. That's not about you.
Well,
I'm talking about this when you were talking about personal profits. When we were talking about profits, I'm talking about taking profits of it. Doesn't this bill preserve the profits of attorneys, right?
Well, let's be careful there, Representative Holm.
Well, I mean, that's what
Representative Guerra doesn't practice in this area of law.
No. I'm not talking about him personally at all, and I don't mean that at all. It's just that we are worried about preserving the ability of the attorneys to get their recompense for what they're doing. And I think Mr. Samuels is doing the same, Representative Samuels is doing the same thing. He's saying, look, those of us who get suits filed against us, nobody's worried about our profits. And I think the two are should be looked at equally, not that one's better than the other. So I think this is probably just fine. You say that the discretion of the judge is in place, or we think that this thing allows the discretion of the judge to be the one who says whether it's substantial or whether the case has merit. Of course the judge is doing that, but I can give you hundreds of examples. I mean, I don't have them at my fingertips, where the judges have, in my opinion, have ruled very inappropriately and have caused just innumerable cases of cost in this state in so many different areas. So I you may be right that Rule 11 says that we, and you know much better the law than I, whether Rule 11 says that we can sanction attorneys for doing actions that are inappropriate or frivolous behaviors. But I just suggest to you, when people can sue and get court orders against companies like McDonald's or dumping coffee in their laps or whatever, all the things that have happened over these years, it's just all kinds of suits. Judges will take these cases many times just to make a name for themselves, and it works. So I don't know anything more than that. But like I said, I'm not a lawyer, so.
Well, no, and I think, Representative Holm, I understand your frustration, and you know there's no question that people who have businesses in this state and other states, I think, are feeling that, trying to get insurance and feeling the frustration. So I understand your particular complaints and those that Representative Samuels have echoed as well. I just want to make one comment on this as we work through it. I mean, I don't think the premise of the bill is wrong. I think that the premise is probably right, and probably injunctions are too liberally granted in some areas. But what I'm trying to figure out is, in looking at it, I see at least seven different terms that to me are vague. Things like substantially prevail, materially damage, improperly disrupt, even in disrupt itself versus improperly. Bad faith, you've submitted that would be interpreted by a judge, but though that's my one area of concern, which is that if we're going to do this, we probably ought to think about what are the sideboards and how do we want to define it. That's what a definition does in my mind, is you say these are the kinds of things that will be material, and these are the kinds of things that will represent a disruption, and so on, and then what does substantially prevail? If the judge rules that you were correct on a couple of the claims that you brought, but not the other, is that substantially? Is it two out of three, or is it one out of three? Or, you know, and so I think that's something we need to think about. And then the second thing I wonder if you thought about, Mr. Pound, Jim, is whether or not you looked at going into Rule 65 and the injunctions itself, and looking at whether or not we want to up the standard for when a court will actually grant an injunction, so that instead of imposing large penalties on those folks who get themselves in that situation in the beginning, that you have a stopping point for the judge right then and there that says, no, you know, we're going to up the standard because of the consequences on businesses and jobs and so on. And I do agree with what Representative Samuels was saying, which is that, Representative Guerra, you were talking a little bit about big guy and small guy, and we do that, and that's appropriate too. But I think at the end of the day, if it's the right thing to do, it's the right thing for big business, small business, or an individual employee. And I do think that we forget a lot about the fact that corporations represent working people. I mean, they have higher up executives that we may view, especially in this climate over the last couple of years as bad or so on, because they take these large profits and these things. But in general, they're providing jobs for average men and women in this state. And so it's real easy to kind of say, well, these big companies, and forget about the fact that it's real jobs. And I wrote on here to Jim Northstar. I was thinking back to that particular complaint that was filed, and it halted production in the Northstar field for almost 2 years, and all of the jobs associated with it. It's now one of the top producing fields in the state, and by all accounts has done it in an environmentally sound way and provided good jobs. So that's my overall sentiment, is that I understand the purpose of the bill. I have long believed that Rule 11 doesn't have enough teeth in it either. And, you know, but I just wonder whether creating a whole separate crime/penalty, if you will, is the right way to go. Because I agree with Representative Guerra also that, I mean, you don't want to have a chilling effect. Maybe it was Representative Guerra or Representative Anderson that talked about the chilling effect that you might have on folks who do believe, I think it was Representative Guerra, you know, the person that's out there and believes there might be something wrong but doesn't have $1 million bond. So have you thought about looking at Rule 65 itself and upping the standard for injunctions?
Madam Chair, interestingly enough, in discussions with the Department of Law when they were going through this bill, not our legal, but actual Attorney General's office, they were leaning to go the other way and drop any reference to the court rules whatsoever, which is part of the amendment that I have, that Section 2 and the... And the references to the rules is not necessary in this legislation. That it essentially just changes claims for damages, and that they'll make their rulings based on existing rules already.
Okay. So, but still getting back to, I guess, and I apologize if I wasn't very clear. I think the point I'm saying is that I grant your point, which is that there are many instances where someone will file an injunction and purposely disrupt an economically viable and environmentally sound project for impure motives. Maybe it's for publicity, maybe it's because they want to see if they might be able to stretch things a little bit and so on, or maybe it's just pure maliciousness. I don't know, but I grant you that there are probably those situations. So what we've said already is that Rule 11 could apply to an attorney that would bring that. Putting that aside, now we're looking at the plaintiffs themselves. We're saying that bad faith is a standard in and of itself, and I don't disagree that we ought to have one. But I think it's the commensurate damages that you're then asking this individual to pay, which could be literally billions of dollars. That is somewhat troubling to me from the standpoint of chilling legitimate injunctions that might be granted. And so I guess what I'm wondering is whether or not we don't want to go back one step, rather than the point at which it's already said and done and you've got a $1 billion penalty hanging over your head, that you go back up one step to the granting of the injunction itself and put more teeth in that, so that the judge has the ability to say, this doesn't look right, feel right, or anything else. We're not granting the injunction. And if these injunctions have been granted in a frivolous way, clearly either the judge has done it improperly or the judge doesn't have enough tools at his or her disposal.
Madam Chair, I haven't looked at Rule 11 on this particular instance in any way, shape, form, or description. And I'm not, my only concern would be, would there not be a legitimate argument if we change Rule 11 to come back against the actual state of who the judge is representing for some of the cost?
Just to clarify for the record, too, I didn't mean Rule 11. I meant the rules governing injunctions themselves, Rule 65. Okay. So Rule 11, I think, as I mentioned earlier, my little note from the B is clearly dealing with the attorney's sanctions themselves. But now what we're trying to say is that plaintiff or group of plaintiffs that might bring the injunction. Anyway, something for you to think about, Representative Samuels, and then Og. Og first. Representative Og.
I don't know. My industry, the fishing industry, has been held up many times by the environmental side of programs. Not that I have anything against them. I mean, they think they're in good faith. The problem that we ran into wasn't so much the injunction process. It's the statutes which they bring the injunction against and the regulations under which the agencies are managing fisheries. They don't have the information, or they're written in such a way that, in good faith, somebody can come and, based on that law, say that this fishery is not being managed properly. So it's actually the law, not the injunction, that tends to be the problem, at least in many fishery cases. It allows people to come in because the law's not written tight enough. And so that's really the place where you need to be impacting this, the process, not on this injunction part. And the only one I had here was this Rule 11, and I'm sure I'm happy to have time to read 65, and I hope we hold this for a while. But they talk in here that you... good faith argument for the extension, modification, or reversal of existing law, and that is not interposed for any proper purpose, such as harassment. So if you're bringing a suit because you think that potentially the law is wrong, or the permit law is wrong itself, that still could be good faith, an injunction, but there would be a chilling effect based on what you have here. Another point that I would like to bring up, besides that we should focus on the laws themselves and not this process, is that a potential defendant would have the ability in one of these cases, when the injunction is brought against them, to counterclaim for compensatory damages under the present law. And so if you already have that right, then why do we need to duplicate it here? If your attorney wasn't clever enough to file the counterclaim, that's, you know, another problem. But,
Mr. Powell?
Through the chair. This primarily is designed to clarify what those compensatory damages could be. At the present time, it's pretty much anyone's guess as to what a compensatory damage would be and what would be awarded under existing statute, because it's, again, very broadly based.
Well, if it,
Representative Og?
You don't mention counterclaims in your thought process here. And what a counterclaim basically is the other side. The person coming in for the injunction basically is saying, there's going to be irreparable damage here if you go ahead. And they have to prove that fairly convincingly to the trial court to grant the injunction because of the potential damage. But the defendant in that particular case, while that injunction is coming and saying, you know, I don't think you're going to prove your case, and I'm counterclaiming for any of the damages that result to me. And who defines what those damages are is the defendant who puts together his counterclaim. He says, these are the damages. We couldn't possibly write a law that would tell somebody what all compensatory damages are in a particular suit. So I think under existing law, at least, that the counterclaim possibility allows for compensatory. But I'd like more time to study this. I don't want to just stop it in its tracks, but there's a lot more stuff that's come up today.
Representative Samuels.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would make a comment. I disagree with what yourself and Representative Anderson said earlier about the costs to be incurred on page 2. Somebody's going to pay for it. And if the person filing it, and if, assuming that it is a bad faith injunction, if they don't pay for it, then we're all going to pay for it. Our insurance company, through higher rate, somebody's going to pay for all of these things that are listed, and probably more than that. So to say that they shouldn't be on the hook for it, well, then we're all on the hook for it. There's no free lunch involved here. If you delay the project and you unemploy the workers, then you've got all the costs that you've incurred, and they're just the cost. That's, you know, that's reality. So I'm if you think you have a, I would agree that you need to make sure you, you know, separate the good faith claims from the bad faith. But once they're found to be bad faith, then they're on the hook because somebody's going to pay. And the people that knew that they went forward with a bad faith claim, they should be the ones that pay. And they should pay the full cost, not just the attorney's cost.
And I think that's a valid point, Representative Samuels. I think what I'm trying to say is that, you know, in all of it, it's a bad deal for the people who are held up on a project. It's a bad deal for the employees. It's a bad deal for the company. And it's a bad deal under this bill for the person who brought the injunction. Everybody's in a bad spot if this comes to pass, if you come to this point. And you're right. All those costs have been expended. Somebody's going to have to pay them. What I'm trying to see, and it follows with what Representative Ogg was saying, is in all of the different steps that we're going through, can we bump it back a step to avoid all of the damages that anyone would pay, one way or the other? And that's what I'm talking about, putting the teeth in an injunction standard. Representative Ogg brought up the statute itself, and that's 940230 that was mentioned in the memo that Representative Guerra received. I mean, I see that as a place. That's authorization for an injunction itself. So maybe you add a subsection 4 that specifically states that it can't be for, you know, based on bad faith and so on and so on, and up it more if you don't think Rule 11 gets you there, because it sounds like you don't. But that's all I'm trying to do is I think your arguments are valid, and once you get to the point where all these costs and penalties have been, all of the costs of holding up the project and so on have been exacted. I mean, you can't put it back in a bottle. It's out there. So what, it's one person paying it or another, and I understand that's why you're introducing the bill. I don't disagree with the goal of the bill. I'm just trying to see whether or not we want to bump it back up a step. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A few things. I mean, first of all, I don't think, despite the sort of heated dialogue, I don't think that we're that far apart on this bill. I suspect that if we clarified Rule 11 to make it clear that you were entitled to full attorney's fees when somebody came in and filed a frivolous lawsuit, I suspect that would really resolve the problem here. But let me address a few things. First of all, this isn't a case of people suing corporations, really. When injunctions are involved, and we're really talking about the public process, the right of a citizen to come in and challenge their government's conduct. And when you're treading on the right of a citizen to challenge their government's conduct, you should tread softly. The only way this bill comes into play is if the government issues a permit. And a citizen says, well, you know, I don't think my government acted properly. And the business knows that this is part of the government process. The permit is issued. Somebody might challenge it. We all know that will likely happen if it's a controversial project. That's just part of the process. But the public is invited into the table. They're invited in and they're told, look, you might not trust your government representatives. You might not trust your agency officials. You as a fisherman, you as a citizens group, you as whoever have the right to come in and challenge your government's conduct. Now, what stops somebody from improperly challenging their government's conduct in a way that causes businesses huge amounts of unjustified damages? What stops them is the threat that if they lose their lawsuit, they might have to pay very huge attorney's fees. The bigger the project, the more attorney's fees you probably have to absorb. If I filed a case against Penn Air, well, Penn Air is not a huge corporation.
Hypothetically,
you know, hypothetically.
Did you have a point of personal privilege?
Clean Air, they went bankrupt.
Oh, I'm getting to you, Representative Holm. I'm getting to you in a moment.
He's got a greenhouse analogy coming right up. You just wait.
Truthfully, I mean, a business the size of Penn Air's, I mean, I can't imagine any, first of all, I can't imagine any injunction that would be filed against Penn Air, but let's say one were filed against a permit granted to Penn Air. They're not a huge corporation. They're not going to hire the biggest attorneys in the world. And if there were a frivolous case against Penn Air, you know, Penn Air would probably accumulate $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 worth of attorney's fees. That's a pretty big penalty for somebody, for a citizen to sort of say, well, gosh, if I file a frivolous lawsuit, I might have to pay that. Yeah, well, you might have to pay that, and that's a pretty significant deterrent to you doing something stupid, to you doing something frivolous. if I file the suit against Exxon and it's frivolous, I'm probably facing an attorney's fee judgment of $500,000 or $600,000 or $1 million. That's a pretty big deterrent. So today, and especially if we clarify Rule 11, the law already deters people from doing frivolous things in court. And we can rewrite this bill in a way that would make sure that the law deterred people from doing things that are frivolous. But to go the next step and say, if you dare challenge the government's issuance of a permit, God, you might be liable for the corporation's profits too, which could be very huge, you've just chilled somebody out of the courtroom. Like it or not, you've taken away the right of the citizen to challenge government conduct in cases involving large corporations. You have, and medium-sized corporations. You've just done it. You know, Representative Holm made the point that seriously. I mean, because sometimes we debate things based on the perception of reality that's different than actual reality, and that's a bad way to make law. You know, I know nothing about the Golden Valley case, but your suggestion that the court agreed to allow the injunction, and your suggestion that the plaintiffs were never penalized, suggests that what Representative Ogg says was correct. Maybe there was a law that the court...